Would you join with me in prayer? May the words of my mouth and the meditations of all our hearts be acceptable to you, O God. You are our rock and our redeemer. Amen. Well, you know, what makes some things so hard to see is not their small size, but their unfortunate location. Like a tick picked up walking through the woods. You feel it as you run your fingers through your hair before you see it with your eyes. Your spouse has to tell you about that new mole on your back. One day recently, I walked around the office for the better part of the morning with my fly unzipped. If only someone had told me. It's also true that the things around you and the places you see every day can surprise you if really you just stop to look. It wasn't until a new person joined our office recently that we realized, wow, there's an awful lot of clutter and junk in this place. From the most prominent shelf in the church office, we tossed out a binder full of clip art from 1988. That doesn't even make any sense to me. The office has moved 3 times since 1988. Why did we never throw out that binder? Yes, it's those things that are closest to us that we have the hardest time seeing. The things that are most personal. The things that are part of us, even inside of us. So Jesus cautions us to be extra careful in passing judgment. It's much easier to notice the log in someone else's eye than it is your own. Well, some things inside of ourselves we cannot see because we've grown so accustomed to them, like that binder. Well, other things we cannot see because we can't stand to look at them. We have to turn away or avert our gaze. We may even develop special skills to deny or avoid those things that are most painful to acknowledge in ourselves. Maybe it's a desire that I wish were not a part of me, or a pain that I nourish but don't acknowledge. Maybe it's a truth that's been there all along, hidden in plain sight. Maybe you can't see that truth from the outside, but I can see that truth from the inside, if only if I could stand to keep looking into myself and accept what I see there. I think of prayer as that inward gaze. When we peer into our own hearts to see what God can also see in us. In prayer, we open ourselves to be read like a book. We read ourselves as God would read us. And we can't pretend that God does not notice those things that we can see inside ourselves, even if we never speak of those inner realities. People like me who come out at some point as gay or lesbian or as transgender might have had the experience that I had. I wouldn't speak of that part of myself because speaking of that part might have made it true. So I would notice that part of myself, but I would not accept it. And if I noticed it, I certainly wouldn't speak about it. O Lord, you have searched me and known me, the psalmist has written. You discern my thoughts from far away, even before a word is on my tongue, O God, you know it completely. If God sees those things in us that we don't acknowledge in ourselves, it's amusing to think that God would not be able to see those things that we can see and acknowledge in ourselves. If you can see it, you can be sure that God sees it too. So there's no use pretending it isn't there. All 3 synoptic gospels, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, prominently feature this transfiguration story, a transcendent mountaintop experience in which Peter, James, and John recognize Jesus as God's beloved Son. It's clear there was a powerful and convincing source for this story. And the three versions of the story are virtually identical. Only small variations exist between them. Matthew, Mark, and Luke all agree about who ascended the mountaintop on that day. They all allude strongly to a similar tale involving Moses in the book of Exodus. They all mention clouds and mist and bright light and glowing faces and a voice announcing from heaven. Matthew and Mark disagree with Luke over when exactly the transfiguration took place. But I think a dispute over whether they went to the mountain 6 days after Jesus' latest teaching or 8 days after the latest teaching is a minor argument in the grand scheme of things. In fact, most of these differences are so slight that only one variation really stands out, and it seems all the more significant because of everything else that the three Gospels agree on. Luke emphasizes that the disciples who accompanied Jesus that day grew drowsy and inattentive. They fell asleep. But in Matthew's story, which we read this morning, Peter and James and John are wide awake the whole time. They stay awake for the whole show. And what I notice in this version is how they stand by watching the cloud descend upon Jesus. They hear clearly the voice from heaven announce, "Jesus is God's beloved Son." Matthew emphasizes this point. They saw it happen. They heard the voice. They fell to the ground, overcome by fear, Matthew says. They couldn't stand the sight of what they saw. So do you get this distinction between the versions of the story? For Luke, it's a story of awakening. They were asleep and they woke up. They're roused from their slumber and startled by what they see, alarmed by what they now notice happening. And I'm sure you could preach a great sermon on Luke's version of the story. In fact, I have to do this every year, and this is number 9, so I've done Luke 3 times now. Today, we're focused on Matthew. And nobody falls asleep in Matthew's version of the story. Their eyes are open the whole time. Dread mounts as they watch this drama unfold. Matthew's version is like an eyewitness account of a terrible event, like a train wreck or a car crash. Oh, yes, yes, I saw it. I saw it happen. I was standing just over there at a great distance. I could see it coming and I could not look away. It was horrible. What does it mean to behold the glory of the Lord, to watch and not be able to turn away? To see it coming and to stay awake for it, that's the story Matthew's telling. To hear the voice, to see the change. I read a very odd article in the New York Times last week about how iPhones are changing how we deal with death. You know, we reach for our phones so habitually, often to snap a photograph. Mobile devices have turned everyone into sort of an amateur photographer. But even in this time of ultimate loss, when we're most inclined to turn away, many people are using their phones to photograph death in their homes. A final portrait of a loved one when the last breath has been taken. How odd. We want to turn away, but we can't stop looking. We can't stop looking so much that we have to have the image preserved. How terrible and how frightening, how humbling and how chastening to look with a steady gaze at that which we do not want to see. And the Hebrew tradition maintains that if we were really to see the face of God, we could not withstand it. Seeing God's face would be so overwhelming, it would consume us in an instant. So when Moses goes up to the mountaintop to receive the tablets from God, and he draws so close to God, he comes back down the mountain, his face glowing like iron from a fire. A friend of mine once told me that there's no better place to hide from God than in church. You know, we think of lost souls as those who have wandered from the fold, the sheep that has been separated from the flock. Jesus says that the shepherd spends a lot of time and energy going after the one who's wandered away. So if you're afraid of being touched by the shepherd, what better place to position yourself than on the inside? Huddled in the middle of the flock, and church is so full of pious practices and moral vocabulary that we could easily deceive ourselves. There are so many good works here for us to perform together that we could easily busy ourselves so much that we never actually have a face-to-face conversation with God in this place. There are so many places to hide from God in church. We can hide from God in the flower guild or in the choir. We can hide from God in the kitchen or in the Sunday school class. Surely God would never look for me in a trustees meeting. And here at United Church of Chapel Hill, we have some really choice hiding places. Have you ever crouched behind our solar panels? Or hidden yourself next to the compost heap? Every pastor knows that we can hide from God behind the numbers that we report for worship attendance or the latest pledge campaign. We can hide from God beneath the goals we set for diversity and equity. But the way of God is not to play this game of hide and seek as children do, surprising us and taking us reluctantly from our hiding places. In the creation myth, God strolls through the garden with the evening breeze, calling out our names with a gentle invitation. And God asked the man, "Why are you hiding?" And the man said, "I heard the sound of you in the garden, and I was afraid. So I hid myself." This old Hebrew tradition is born out of fear for God. It says that we shouldn't look at the face of God because we couldn't stand what we would see there. But this mysterious tale of Jesus on the mountaintop tells us something rather different. When we behold the presence of God, it may not consume us, but it does change us. When we look at God face to face, we find God's graciousness and God's love. And that's what so terrified and captivated the disciples that day. Jesus wasn't consumed by the presence of God. He was embraced by God's presence. He was blessed by God's presence. So what happened on the mountaintop was a humbling encounter with the truth. God's love disclosed in fullness and in glory. God's grace revealed in mystery and in power. A gentle invitation to come out from our hiding places, to look at that which we are afraid to face, to open ourselves in prayer that we may see in ourselves what God also sees there, to accept ourselves inside and out, that we may remember the sacredness in which God has created us. This is the story of the Transfiguration today. Luke and Mark may tell it differently, but for Matthew, this is what matters for us now. To see ourselves and to see one another as God sees us. Amen.